Thanks so much for joining us today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and today we talk about what we should be both concerned and hopeful about our changing climate with our guest, Bill Weir. He's the chief climate correspondent for CNN, former host and executive producer for the CNN original series, The Wonder List with Bill Weir. Bill's also the author of the new book. It's a dandy. It's titled Life as We Know It Can Be, kind of can be in parentheses, published in April. And the subtitle is Stories of People, Climate, and Hope in a Changing World. Milwaukee native, early in his career, Bill spent a few years in Wisconsin as a sports anchor at WLUK-TV in Green Bay. So he's got lots of experience with Wisconsin as well as the rest of the world. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in as we visit about climate. What about climate change worries you? Have you maybe even asked the young people in your life what they're worried about as far as the future is concerned? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Bill Weir, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Are you kidding me, Larry? It is so great to be with you. I love Wisconsin so much, everything about it. And I'm thrilled to spend some time with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I tell you what, you've written a dandy book. And The book started, I think, Earth Day 2020, something like that. You started writing letters to your son?
Yeah, exactly. So I became a new old dad in the spring of 2020. My daughter, Olivia, who inspired me, inspired much of my life, as our kids tend to do. When I looked at, Olivia and I have the same birthday in 2003. And I think when she was 11, I looked at her and realized she was going to turn my age in the year 2050. And it gave me this idea for the Wonder List where I said, I want to go to the wonders of the world and wonder what will be left of them when she's my age. And greatest green light of my life. I got to just truly see the world, Larry, change my perspective on so much. And then, my new partner, we didn't think we could become parents. She very much wanted to become a mom. Olivia's stepmom now. And so when little River came along, my son, at the height of the pandemic, I'm holding this squirming little bundle and realizing this kid could live to see the 22nd century. And so much was happening in the first weeks of his life nationally with the pandemic. And I covered the George Floyd fallouts. And so I started writing these sort of letters of apology, you know, sorry, welcome to the party. We're really glad you're here. Sorry, we broke the sea and the sky. But I'm going to look for, as Mr. Rogers taught me, I'm going to look for the helpers when things get scary. And so I set out to sort of just write a practical guide, like where should he live? What kind of house should he build? And in the end, I ended up actually with more wonder than worry.
Yeah, with more wonder than worry. And the book, I loved how you organized this book. I mean, you start out with Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yeah.
Which, what do we got on the base? We've got physiological needs, then we've got the safety, then we've got love, then we've got esteem, and then right at the top of the pyramid is self-actualization. How did you land on that?
Well, Larry, I started just with the basic, like, how did we get ourselves into this mess? You know, I was raised, my dad was a Milwaukee, smartest high school dropout I ever knew. I loved history and geology, and he made me fall in love with nature, you know, and hiking in the Wisconsin Dells or splashing in Silver Lake in Washera County. But he would always say, well, it's just a matter, enjoy this while it's here. It's just a matter of time before somebody puts a golf course there, you know? And so he filled me with equal parts sort of wonder for natural world, but also worry about human nature and how we can lose things and if we're not careful. And so when I thought, what caused the problem? It's really our wants and needs as 8 billion humans. And if you start talking about human motivation, you end up with the OG, you know, godfather of humanism, Abraham Maslow, who wrote this theory in 1943. He'd come up with this come from a horrible childhood. His mother was horrible to him. And he became obsessed with the most mentally healthy in society. And he figured if we just understand each other's needs and fill them up, then we can be the best that we're meant to be and get along and live in a world of peace. He was a real idealist. And I realized that, wow, you know, I took the bottom of my pyramid for granted when I was a kid growing up. I never thought about the quality of the water in Silver Lake or where our food came from, how it was grown, or the cost of our energy choices. I didn't. And now my kids don't have the luxury of not considering that stuff. Yeah. And I argue that if we connect with each other around the bottom of the pyramid, around air and water and bracing for hotter temperatures and growing our food in the most sustainable ways, we will fill our love and esteem needs in ways that, you know, social media and shopping sprees just can't do.
Oh, man. Well, let's talk about air for a minute. You talk about in that chapter about the carbon Godzilla, and you talk about a guy, Marty Odlin, I think it is.
Yes, name was. Yeah. Yeah, this guy's he's a fisherman scientist who grew up on the docks of Maine. He's fourth generation. All he wanted to do was sort of chase cod and mackerel in the Gulf like his forebears. And he went to study at Dartmouth and Columbia and came back and realized the Gulf of Maine had heated up four times faster than the rest of the planet. And most of the fishing stocks were gone. He did the math. It just didn't make sense to get a lease in a boat. So he started an ocean repair company trying to pull carbon out of the sea and the sky using oyster beds and kelp rafts. And we're talking about my frustration with how we talk about this story. You know, it's the worst when it comes to a planetary existential crisis. It's the worst branding in history. You know, global warming, warmth, people like warmth. And nobody's afraid of the greenhouse. People, we like greenhouses. You know, we grow tomatoes and flowers. And he said, it's a Godzilla. It's a carbon Godzilla. And that clicked for me, like this light bulb moment that humanity, through our brilliance, we've unlocked all of this, you know, dinosaur juice from the earth. And at first, it helped us do the heavy lifting. It built the modern world. It expanded our lifespans. But the carbon monster in the sky got so big, it's now 1.5 trillion tons. He says, you know, it's destroying our fish and melting our snow and ruining our farms and making everything that's great about life, you know, harder. We should get angry and go kill that thing, chop it up and bury it down and stop making it bigger. And that just sort of crystallized the debate, you know, like every day, how can we make carbon Godzilla a little less bigger in our choices? How can we urge people to help us chop it down? What are the new ideas on chopping carbon Godzilla and burying it back from whence he came? Because until we do that and even out the number, you know, parts per million in the atmosphere, you know, this is just the warmest summer in the Northern Hemisphere in 2,000 years, but it's also one of the coolest of the rest of our lives at the current rates. And we have to brace for what's coming.
Yeah, we do indeed. Well, his idea, I think it was his idea, was, and you mentioned these thousands of buoys.
Yeah. Yeah, he's betting on, he looked at a bunch of different technologies. You have direct air capture, which are machines that suck it out of the sky, right? And again, Larry, you think about it like, yeah, it's a gas. We can't see it. We can't smell it. But the idea that we have to move billions of tons of it, and these are, you know, corporations and scientists and the government all agree on, academics agree on this. First, there must be, you know, we have to stop making him bigger in the first place and electrify and end the era of fossil fuels that burn. We've been burning stuff just because it was abundant and cheap, whether it was trees or dung or whales or kerosene. But now for the first time in human history, the two cheapest forms of energy are solar plus storage and onshore wind. That's why Texas leads the nation in clean energy. But we have to think in these new terms, but also we have to draw down a lot of this in order to undo some of the damage. And that means shipyards and trains and guys in hard hats and you know, steel-toed boots, moving mass and figuring out a way to get it underground. Some people are taking farm waste and turning it into bio oil and injecting it back into old salt mines or oil wells. You know, some people say we should just bury our human waste and where the methane doesn't release. And by that way, you're controlling lots of ways to tackle this. But he bet on seaweed. Kelp has the ability to pull down carbon at a rate, you know, four times faster than trees. And so he designed these rafts that are made of waste material wood and kelp seeds and limestone, which acts as sort of Tums for the ocean, because the other big problem with all this carbon Godzilla is it's changing the acidity, the pH levels in the ocean. And so if you could take 2.5 Mount Fijis of limestone and sprinkle it in the ocean, like at the top surface, some think it would even that out like a giant Tums. So these rafts would do that. And as the kelp grows into this microforest, once it gets heavy enough, it cuts itself and would sink to the bottom of the ocean, where that carbon would be locked away for a couple hundred years. We don't know if this works at scale. You know, it's one idea. He's also using oyster beds, which draw it down and holds the carbon in their shells and then creates a protein source, an income source for coastal communities. But it's kind of cool that he's trying, and he's getting lots of investment, a lot of scientific backing to see if this works. And while he was doing research off the coast of Iceland, they figured out a way to hook up the data coming, because you got to measure this stuff and beam it into the cloud in like 5-foot seas, you know? And so we're in the cusp of an industrial revolution, Larry, that most people can't even comprehend. And trillions of dollars are going to pour into ideas like these in industries that we haven't even been talking about yet.
Yeah, and I love all of the stories and examples that you include in your book about the host of all of these needs that we have. You make some really cool points that I didn't know. There are so many times in the book I didn't know that. You were talking about temperature, and you say in your lifetime, the Earth has lost a 15-foot deep block of ice the size of the U.S.
Yes. Yeah, it's hard to imagine, right? So Earth has been cycling through hot and cold for 4.5 billion years, you know, and basing on the wobble of our rotation, you know, if it shifts us a little bit more, it can start more, you know, warmer ages and it shift away, and these billion year life, you know, time scales have turned the thermostat on Earth up and down over time. But what we've done as one species in a blink of Earth time is staggering, you know. So 4.5 billion is too much to wrap our heads around. That's too big of a number. But my dad taught me this trick is, if you scale it down to the lifespan of a 45-year-old, say a 45-year-old house.
Yeah.
Right? In a 4.5 billion, 45-year-old house. The Himalayas were installed 5 years ago. Yeah. Human beings showed up 3 months ago, and the Industrial Revolution 60 seconds ago. And in that time, we've managed to melt a block of ice, you know, like you say, the size of the continental United States, 15 feet thick. And we've also pumped enough groundwater and without replacement to fill our thirsty crops, feed our livestock and all of that, to shift the gravity, to shift the position of the North Pole, because the centrifugal force is changing as we alter ice and water on the planet. The poles are melting at such staggering rates. Paleoclimatologists, I'm telling you, when you really sit down with them, the cameras will stop rolling. Man, they're really worried. They're really worried because it's happening so much faster than they even predicted 5 years ago.
Bill Weir, our guest today, his book, Life as We Know It Can Be, Stories of People, Climate, and Hope in a Changing World. Questions for him or comments, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Joel Patnod, our producer today. Jeff Robbins, our technical director. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR. Larry Mueller here. We're talking today about global and local climate challenges with our guest, Bill Weir, who is the author of Life as We Know It Can Be, Stories of People, Climate, and Hope in a Changing World. Great to have him along. And again, join in 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. I love reading the stories of the people that are trying to deal with each of these areas You know, when it comes to temperature, and Kelly Wanzer comes to mind as an
yep.
Here's a person who's trying to do something.
Yeah, Kelly is a really impressive woman. She was an executive in Silicon Valley in sort of systems management, and she says she had a conversation with a climate scientist who told her that the odds of sort of a total collapse were unstoppable, where they say the boreal forests and the tundra up way up in the Arctic melts and releases sort of methane bombs, which makes things worse, and Antarctica and a big glacier goes in, which then makes things worse. We're in the single digits, but not a small single digit. And that was enough for her to completely change her life, quit her job, move to Washington, and start a company called Silver Linings, or not a company, but an NGO, think tank sort of lobbying group called Silver Linings, to get CEOs and lawmakers and others to think about atmospheric solar radiation management. They call it sort of climate repair, short-term climate repair. And this idea has been floating around for decades. It's the real science started in the 90s, back when I was actually probably covering the Brett Favre Packers. And I think it was 93 when Mount Pinatubo erupted in the Philippines.
Yeah.
And the ash and the, you know, soot from that was enough up in the stratosphere to shade the Earth and cool it a full degree for like a year and a half, something like that. And so scientists have wondered, could we create some sort of sunscreen in the sky to buy ourselves time to slow down the warming so the rest of the world could adapt to what's coming? And different ideas have been floated, you know, everything from spraying basically salt spray to diamonds in the sky and different natural things, and how they would float in all of this is, there's no science on this. And there's no real fleet of aircraft that can do this. A lot of people worry that rogue billionaire is just going to start plotting out the sun on his own and how that would, you know, set off different kinds of monsoon patterns rather. So there's a lot of resistance to this idea. In fact, when Harvard tried to float a balloon over Sweden, I believe, way up in the Arctic, and just sprayed, you know, less particulate matter than you would just taking a drive in your car. And the resistance from environmental groups and indigenous folks was so much, they eventually shut the whole thing down. Mexico outlawed it after some guy started selling cooling credits and launching balloons with this stuff. Anyway, her argument is that we should at least explore the possibility. It's one of those case of emergency break glass ideas. And I'll be honest, Larry, when I first heard about this 8 years ago, people were like, that's nuts. Now it was like the main topic of conversation at the conference of the American Geophysical Union. So we're there. We're really smart people are talking about sunscreen in the sky.
You know, we have a history, albeit not the greatest, of actually doing something. And you point that out when you just talked about the Montreal Protocol.
Right. Yeah. That's probably the most successful example of international environmental treaty. The chlorofluorocarbon CFCs that we used to use in our air conditioning and cooling units and all of that. I think 190 countries signed on to the Montreal Protocol to phase out these chemicals that were just punching a hole in the ozone layer. I still remember, you know, we were talking about our worries about the ozone layer, acid rain, more cataracts as the more powerful, you know, spectrum of sunlight gets through. The ozone protects us from so much evil flying around in our galaxy there. And it worked. It worked. But what's interesting, and the ozone hole is healing. It also might have bought us some time on terms and prevented more warming as sort of a side effect of this. But what's interesting about that treaty is the United States was totally in favor of it because our manufacturing base would have profited more. They already had the technology to come up with the replacement for those chemicals. And so the Chamber of Commerce and the lobbies were all for it. Now, getting all these countries to agree on something this sort of controversial extreme would be so difficult because there's not much of a profit motive. You know, who pays for this? How do you orchestrate it between countries? If you fly these sorties, you could use rockets, you could use different things. You have to do it constantly, or else it's like opening an oven door and the heat will just come back. And who knows how this affects the ocean. So again, it's one of those things where James Hansen actually, who warned Congress, one of the original climate scientists who says this is real, he said at least has to be considered. While other scientists like Michael Mann at Penn State say, no, we still have so much work we can do right here and avoid the worst warming.
You know, Peggy in Chippewa Falls has a comment that kind of relates to this, I think. Let's go there. Peggy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I just am, I'm sorry, I'm turning so I can park here. Yeah. I'm just concerned about why climate change has become a political issue. And when did that start? You know, why are the Republicans denying that there is, and generalize, I'm just generalizing there. Why are they saying that there is no such thing as climate change, where the Democrats hopefully realize that, yes, it is real and it's destroying our Earth for our children? And I also just heard on the news the other day that DeSantis has instated a law that is none of the weather people can talk about climate change. And how can that be? I'm just perplexed here.
Good questions, Peggy. On the last part, the law in Florida that the governor, he basically stripped out the language around climate change and took it away as a priority of how they plan and permit. There's no prohibition, but a weather, probably what you saw was there's a meteorologist, Steve McLaughlin, I believe is his name, who went on the air and said, this is ridiculous. We are living through, like, Florida may be the most vulnerable state to climate change in the union, between hurricanes, algae blooms, sea level rise, all of those things. And to not make it part of the conversation as we plan our futures, you know, he was making a statement on that. That's what made news there as well. It's really fascinating because this is, you know, the Republican Party is the party of Teddy Roosevelt. The words conservative and conservation are just a few letters apart, and was the case up until George H.W. Bush signed the first global climate pact in Rio de Janeiro. And if you remember, some people even remember a PSA with Nancy Pelosi and Newt Gingrich sitting on a couch in front of the Capitol saying the one thing we can agree on is coming together around climate. But you know, the storyline changed in the Republican Party because it's the most profitable companies in human history. Their entire business model is now at risk. And for the longest time, they denied it was happening. But this is the subject of dozens of lawsuits, cities, states, tribes suing big oil companies, big polluters, basically for hiding the side effects and knowing about it for a generation. And there's internal memos from Exxon and a whole evidence trail that is now working its way through the courts to decide, should they have to then pay for this? But yes, the at this point to deny, it was one thing to say, well, maybe we can't do anything about it, or maybe we can't slow down our economy. More people would suffer if we do that. You can make those points. But to argue it is not happening at this point is just delusional. And I think the more especially the younger generation understands this, and I'm about to write an op-ed, actually, calling on every weatherman in every market in the country and local newsrooms, because I work my way up from Austin, Minnesota, through Green Bay. I worked in Chicago and L.A. newsrooms, imploring my old newsrooms and my old colleagues who are there and have a moral responsibility to put context on these unnatural events and say, here's what growing season used to look like. Here's where it is now. Here's what the scientists say. You don't have to take a stance. You don't have to make it political. but at least put these unnatural events into context for folks so they can understand what's really happening and it's not just a run of bad luck.
It's kind of a whipsaw. And, you know, you wrote to your son, River, that we're going to probably whipsaw between progress, setback, inspiration, despair.
Yeah.
And do you worry that environmental roller coaster is going to frustrate your son's generation?
I think so. I mean, if you think about it, I know we don't like to think about the COVID pandemic, but it's a little sort of 3-4 year microcosm of human nature, both the wondrous potential and also the mistakes and that whipsaw that we ride on, right? When my little boy was, I saw him on an ultrasound. He was the size of a kiwi. If you could have typed COVID-19 into Google, he'd have gotten zero results. By the time he could open kitchen cabinets, you know, billions of people around the world had masked up and changed their habits, and every big lab in the world was working on testing and a cure. And, you know, and so, but we also made a ton of mistakes, I think, in that time, because there was so much disruption and fear and people were lost, and we need to honor their memories. And so that's kind of like the ride I imagine going forward. There's going to be incredible breakthroughs in clean energy systems and maybe carbon removal and who knows what else. But I think we're going to have to go on this ride. Right now, there's the EV market is slowing down. So you're seeing headlines about, you know, and I bet if you went back and read papers a century ago where there was the same kind of daily trickle of stories, is the horse making a comeback? Has Henry Ford, you know, reached market saturation? Like, but at a certain point, you know, it just becomes part of history. And the shift now in terms of a new electrified future, and it goes so far beyond that. It goes into communities really connecting with each other and with the ecosystems they live in, and understanding them in ways that modern life, you know, makes all of that optional. And outside is outside. What happens outside is the most important. And more time we spend out there with each other, seeing the changes, talking about solutions, the less pain we'll feel, and certainly our kids will.
Yeah. Don in Iron River has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Don.
Hey, hi. I grew up in Madison, and I've been coming up to the Brule River since 1978 for fishing. And I built my cabin in 2002, and it was very, very, very cold in August, way back when. And now I got by with a dehumidifier. And 10 years ago, I had to put an air conditioner in.
It's crazy.
Yeah, crazy.
Isn't it amazing?
You do talk
That's
about...
That's the thing.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Larry. Go ahead, please.
No, you go ahead, Bill.
No, I just, I hear that sort of thing, and that's kind of my beat. I'm so gifted that I work for a place that believes in this story, even before I was on the climate beat, but just let me wander and talk to folks. And the thing I really leaned into, especially with the Wonderlist, is change. What have you seen change in your life? And if, you know, you don't believe it, talk to the fishermen, the anglers, the sportsmen and women, the bird hunters in my home state of Wisconsin, and they'll tell you. And then you have to go through, you know, I use, in addition to Abraham Maslow in this book, I draw on the work of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who invented hospice care and gave us the five stages of grief. And, you know, she was practicing medicine at a time in the late 60s when 90% of doctors in a big Chicago hospital wouldn't tell cancer patients that they were terminal. But when they did, she wanted to understand what they were going through. And the five stages are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And folks are going through those stages in their hometowns, you know, not having left, missing the way your caller described, a cold August. I mean, imagine what's Door County like without Fall Fest and ice festivals, and what does that mean to the wildlife? And what and all of that is, it's a big thing to process through. So it's easy to stick in denial. And But the sooner we can kind of understand, here's what's happening, here's the trend, here's what we can do about it, and get into a level of not acceptance doesn't necessarily mean surrender, but at least it means, okay, I'm working on a planet with a new set of physical rules, and the old fishing seasons and everything, you know, past is no longer prologue. And it breaks me that my grandpa's Silver Lake in Washera County near Wautoma is not the one that my little boy River will see. It's rough.
Yeah. Mary in Pewaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Well, hi. Love your show. Thank you to the guest. And I have the book on my wish list already. And my question is, what are your opinions about the e-car, because we bought one last year. We try to be more and more efficient in, you know, using less, and we have a compost pile and all of that. But then we read, you know, several things about, you know, the battery, which needs to be replaced like every 10 years, and how much that battery uses with the 3 tons of nickel ore and 12 tons of copper.
Sure.
And the mining of the lithium, et cetera. You're probably familiar with most of that. Can I get your opinion on that, please?
Absolutely. It's a great question, Mary. A lot of people are, you know, kicking these tires for the first time, and especially if you want to do the right thing. But miles to miles, there's no comparison. And just in terms of, I think I've seen, you know, if you drive it over the life of your car, by the time you hit maybe a year and a half in or 15,000 miles, from that mile onward, your car will be a positive, you know, is much better than it would have been. Whereas if the length of your gasoline powered car, it's sort of the way, you know, we can talk about the cost of building wind turbines, you know, the physical structures, the steel and all of that. But over the lifespan, it is so much more better for the ecology. It's better for the climate situation. The thing also about EVs is that at a certain point, there will be enough recyclable material. So the minerals that in batteries can be used again and again and again, as opposed to, you know, a ton of carbon fuel based fuel. You burn it, it's gone, right? And the beauty of electrifying everything, and this is why 90% of the new power plants that are coming online and are now permitted coming up are renewable energy, solar or wind power right now, is that once you build a solar farm or a wind farm, the energy delivers itself to you. You don't have to go chasing it under mountains and oceans and piping it across continents. And so as the, you know, the charging source for your EV gets cleaner, your choice to make to drive that way just gets cleaner over time. Same with your house if you go with an induction stove. And so much can be done in that space too. I write about shelter and how much waste is sort of built into our lives when we don't even know it. Just by stripping it out, we make so much of a better change. But the EVs market now is in the middle of a tug of war with China. They've figured out a way to build really cheap EVs. They've got one that's $10,000 model, and that's why the tariffs just kicked in. Joe Biden is trying to stop that and give the domestic EV industry a time to beef up. The big companies right now are sort of softening. It's sort of like they saw a huge demand and they put too much in the pipeline and there wasn't enough uptake right then, but that might even out over time. The companies that are EV only are growing and taking more of the market share away from the traditional automakers. So again, this is sort of like my COVID and the vaccine analogy. Like, yeah, there's all this sort of business news that roils around as this entire new industry explodes. But for people who have them and love them, you know, I've driven a bunch of them, and the charging infrastructure is coming out in new, exciting ways too. The range anxiety is going on. I rented my first EV on a trip to see my grandma, you know, my stepmom out in Oregon. And that was like a moment, right? Like, that's an option. Okay, let me try that. And the more people sort of taste it, the adoption will go even faster, I think.
Yeah. Mary, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You mentioned housing in your comments just now, and shelter is something you do talk about in your book. You, and by the way, we're dealing with a serious issue, but so many, you've had so many experiences that you write about in the book that are so funny. But you talk about working as a young guy for a Saudi prince building right. his home, and then you kind of compare that to Norman Klebold and his net yeah. zero community.
Yeah, so this was one of those amazing, I've been sort of Forrest Gumping my way through life, Larry, you know, like riding this feather. My dad, who was a cop with the Milwaukee Police Department, and then just kind of had a midlife, like, I'm out of here. He was wanted to be a mountain man. So he quit everything and moved out to Colorado and lived sort of in a little funky trailer park just down valley from Aspen, the ski resort there. And so I spent my summers and Christmases with him. My folks split up early and my mom sort of took me around the country on a sort of gypsy existence, but I'd spend my summers with my dad in the outdoors. And he was a detective when he quit the PD, but he ended up getting a job in the nail room at a lumber yard in Aspen and worked his way up to sort of a salesman to contractors and got me in as a carpenter's apprentice and a laborer working in the summers, which was awesome, you know, building houses under the Colorado sky. And the houses were just insane, man. You know, they got bigger and bigger. And then Prince Bandar Al Saud, this is one of the princes of Saudi Arabia. He was the ambassador to the United States at the time, really good friends with the Bush family. He loved to ski and shop. And so he would come and hang out for a couple weeks and stay in the hotel. And then he decided to build a house. And he built a 55,000 square foot home in Starwood above Aspen. It was bigger than the Pitkin County Airport at the time. And I worked on that house. But also when it was finished, he hired a bunch of the guys on the crew to be his drivers. And I ended up sort of chauffeuring these three Saudi security guards around. And at the time in the 80s, you know, this was like, wow, this is living. This is peak existence. Look at this. Look at he had his favorite English pub from London dismantled and reassembled in this house in Aspen, you know, just over the top opulence. And my dad was always get depressed when I tell him about that stuff. And I didn't think about it until, you know, much later. And I'm back in Colorado to visit the first net zero community, which people had built sort of in a direct resistance to Saudi oil dominance and just waste. And there was an idea that came out of the oil embargoes of the 70s when my first memory was waiting in gas lines with my dad in Milwaukee. At that time, there was a team at the University of Illinois said, what if we could build a house for a climate like Madison's, but uses 2/3 less energy? And using early computer models, they realized, well, we do it wrong in this country. We build houses with skinny walls and giant furnaces and air conditioners when it should be the other way around. And so they proposed sort of a Pueblo style, thick, really well insulated walls with southern exposure to catch the sunlight. And, you know, with the air filtered through, much more efficient. But the United States never picked it up. Jimmy Carter lost. Ronald Reagan took the solar panels off the White House. Conservation became sort of a dirty word politically. And the Germans took this idea and ran with it and developed what is now known as the passive house. And this is the first time I toured these sorts of homes, which were so well insulated. They use so little energy. You can heat the place, even in a place like Colorado, with body heat and warmth from your appliances in some cases. The filtration system, as it flushes the dirty air out, it captures the energy and uses it to heat or cool the fresh air as it comes in. And it was just inspiring to see that. And now I'm a dad. I nerd out over stuff like insulation, R numbers, and all of that. And just how the story in my mind had shifted from when I was a kid to that the 55,000 square foot home was the dream. When I realize now how much wasteful that is, where now I hope my kid thinks that a really well built passive house is the dream, you know? And yeah. And there you go.
And more of those are being built now, thankfully, in the U.S. Our guest today, Bill Weir. Bill Weir's book is titled Life as We Know It Can Be. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Talking today with Bill Weir, author of Life as We Know It Can Be, as stories of people, climate, and hope in a changing world. You can join in too. Number to call 800 642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. You visited blue zones.
Yes.
Places where people live longer and healthier lives. How do they do it?
Well, it is an interesting thing. I went to this, I've now been to a couple of the blue zones. My friend Dan Buettner, he's a National Geographic fellow who would stage these sort of global expeditions as a young man and stumbled across the fact that Okinawa, Japan had a much higher rate of longevity than anywhere else. He had women there living, sort of the longest living women in the world. Well, you know, at a rate much higher than the West. He thought, that's an interesting mystery. And so they'd look with demographers and physicians and try to figure out pockets of these sort of longevity hotspots, and they'd circle them with blue ink, and I became known as the Blue Zones. And I did these stories with Dan at ABC News, my first one, went to Ikaria, Greece, this rocky little island where people lived at like 4 to 100 at a rate four times greater, not just to the U.S., but even some other islands in Greece. And there was something about that island. And you go there thinking it's going to be a silver bullet, some sort of reverse trawl or whatever. But you realize it's a buckshot of a bunch of different factors. That it's a lot of it's the Mediterranean diet, a lot of beans and veggies. They do eat meat, but it's a special occasion kind of treat. And there's natural movement throughout the day, very hilly. There is real cross-generational reverence. And so you go to a party at 2 a.m, you got 10-year-olds and 85-year-olds hanging out together. The elders are childcare, their sense of purpose laid into your life. It's the social bond is so strong. It's the kind of place where if you miss church, somebody's going to knock on your door to check on you. It's the kind of place where if you have to hand your baby to somebody because of an emergency, you got a dozen choices. And I started, you know, keeping track of these ingredients for sort of the healthiest, happiest, most sustainable communities in the world, and tried to, you know, bring them back. They have a honey there that they eat every morning with a big spoonful. It tastes like, looks like peanut butter, and tastes like gin. It's because the bees pollinate this pine, and to them it's like natural Viagra, but it coats the digestive tract. It's an anti-inflammatory, and like any, you know, if you're using honey from pollinators, if wherever you live in Wild Rose, Wisconsin, or wherever you are, that helps your immune system as well. There's some science behind that. But what I realized, Larry, is that the places that I admired, and I also went to Vanuatu in the South Pacific, which is always at the top of the happiest countries list, went to Denmark, which is usually number one, and to a place, the things they have in common is their trust and connection with each other, and their natural surroundings, and their seasons, their ecosystems, their air, their water, the bottoms of their pyramids. They are as much a value to them as any kind of status, and that's how they fill their love and esteem needs.
It's a fascinating story. Dave and Toma, will give you a chance. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. Say, one of the things, the problem is kind of the mindset he was portraying earlier. He was talking about building new efficient houses. Something we can do right now is study how to rehab the houses, the housing stock we have. We can't really, I don't think we have the resources to build an efficient house for everybody. And we should be studying ways to rehab the houses we have without having to gut them and basically rebuild them. That would go a long ways towards solving things.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. I totally agree, Dave. That's a great point. I get into that as well. My chapter on the passive houses talks very much about, not only does the National Association of Realtors and others say we need to build 5 million new homes to keep up with just the demand of population, but we have to rehab, you know, countless tens of millions that were built before the Reagan administration, just as you say. And there are companies, there's a whole innovative sort of green tech building thing that's happening with that very problem. A company called Energy Spring or Energy Sproing is in Dutch, is a company in the Netherlands that means leapfrog in Dutch. And they figured out a way to make panels that you put on the outside of your existing construction that's basically like a tea cozy for the whole house. And the challenge they've had with American homes is that we don't have the same sort of uniform construction taste as they do in some places else. And so, you know, doing it around a colonial or some, you know, an Art Deco may be different challenges for the builders. But there's also ideas that if you have an energy audit, and there's ways you can, there's now something that was invented by a professor just in his garage that's basically like fix-a-flat for your house. You spray an aerosol that seals every crack, even up to, you know, half inch big, a whole half inch big. It's a natural material, non-toxic, and would tighten up your existing home in ways that would save you really tangible money off your heating bills. But here again is what I threw out 4, 5, 6 ideas in the book of people who are doing stuff, mostly to get people excited about the next idea, because this is like, again, there are future billionaires walking around who are thinking about just that. How do we rehab homes and make them passive or passive-ish, even though they were built a long time ago?
Yeah. Dave, thank you very much for calling. You write that about 200 million to maybe a billion people will be uprooted by an unnatural disaster in their lifetime, and at least 13 million people will migrate from the coastal communities of the U.S. as the seas rise. And you talk about where's the best place to go, and, you know, Canada, maybe Wisconsin, Buffalo, sure. New York came to mind. But I like the concept you talked about. There's all the resistance. There's this NIMBY kind of thing. And actually, there's some of that going on, being written about right now by the Wisconsin State Journal regarding Madison. But there's also YIMBY.
Right. Yeah, the original NIMBYs were, at least when I remember them growing up as a Gen Xer, were environmentalists trying to stop, you know, big nuclear power plants or developments. So not in my backyard became their rallying cry. These days, it is more likely to be used by affluent, relatively affluent white Americans trying to stop either more dense housing in their neighborhood or a wind or solar project. And social scientists have gone back and looked at, you know, the average wind, group that opposes, say, a wind turbine development somewhere is 16. And that's not 16%, 16 people who have the time and motivation to show up at every meeting and do everything they can to stop this clean energy project that's coming in. And that doesn't mean every idea is perfect for every place. And unfortunately, we've kicked this can down the road so long, Larry, there are no easy decisions anymore. I love desert tortoises, but if the desert tortoise, you know, keeps gigawatts of solar power from being installed in the American West or something, these are conversations we have to figure out. And so much of the clean energy future and where people will migrate to, where new industries will pop up, will be based on NIMBYs versus YIMBYs. Yes, in my backyard. And I look at YIMBY examples in the book that comes from really surprising places. As I said, Texas is a model at building out clean energy and building transmission lines to carry it. The rest of the other parts of the grid, so the U.S. grid is divided into three big pieces: East Coast, West Coast, and Texas. And Lone Star Fashion has their own energy pretty much for 90% of the state. But because the economics are so cheap for wind and sun now, and because they have a lot of YIMBYs, libertarians, who don't like government red tape and say, yeah, there's going to be a bunch of people living there, let's run a transmission line now, it's building out faster in places like that. And then we'll attract more industry because they're figuring out ways to take all that free energy. Literally, it is free in the middle of the day. There's so much sun and wind in California and Texas. But now you just have to store it. And so with thermal batteries, which are basically big, hot rocks in a box that can hold enough heat to make steel or run a factory, that will attract a whole new industrial belt to these windy places. And so the NIMBYs
yes
and the YIMBYs,
in my backyard.
Something to keep an eye on.
Not in my backyard. Bill Weir, thank you so much for being with us today. I love how you ended the book to your son and daughter. Every time you help the bottom of someone else's pyramid of needs, you fill the top of your own. It's a wonderful book. I really appreciate having you with us today here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Bill Weir, our guest. Thanks, Bill. And thank you for listening in. I'm Larry Mueller.